Welcome to another episode of Three Men and a War Game. And I might actually say two and a half men in a war game, since we can't hear Paul and he's on shitty hotel Wi-Fi. I am your new host for this week, Chops, and I have nothing clever to say because I got put on the spot.
And I am Potter, and it has been an interesting week. I don't have anything clever to say as well, because this has been a clusterfuck of fun trying to get this working.
All right, Paul, you go ahead and talk for 15 seconds or 5 seconds. I'll just stay quiet here.
I am Paul, and I travel a lot for work, and this hotel sucks my ass.
I actually heard most of that. I heard hotel ass, so I figured you said something about bad at hotel at Wi-Fi. So this is going to be a weird episode. It's going to be me talking to Chris mostly and hoping to be able to decipher Paul's swimming pool audio. We'll start the episode as per normal, which is talking about what we've been done, what we've been doing, and a lot of us have been off for a few weeks here. We haven't actually recorded an episode in over 3 weeks, so you guys should have some stuff to report on. And I will start. I'll go ahead and just rattle what I've been doing off. Since the last time we spoke, I actually painted an entire Shadespire warband. I painted the orc boys, and I painted them to look like space wolves, because I'm an asshole and that's the kind of thing that I do. I'm sure that there'll be some pictures up on the Twitter now that I've noted that, and the guys have seen pictures of these models at every stage. I just, for whatever reason, got an itch to paint them like space wolves, so I went ahead and did it. Outside of that, I finished up an Eldar kill team, and I am currently painting some A Song of Ice and Fire minis.
I feel so inadequate with my hobby time now. Jesus, you did all that while on vacation.
Uh-huh.
I wasn't on vacation. I got shit done. I literally got, like, base coated one fucking model in 3 weeks. Yeah, I feel inadequate now. So did some hobby hangouts with our patrons, or our patron, Bab. So got most of Frank James painted for my Jesse James crew. Other than that, I've been playing. Got a couple of games in for Adepticon prep for Wild West Exodus, two or three games in. And then just kind of building some models as well, too. Got some more Wild West Exodus stuff built. So just been kind of on that kick prepping for Adepticon.
I forgot to mention games. Paul and I actually played a game of Shadespire at Disney World. It was crazy.
Yay!
he whooped my ass.
The cards were perfect, though.
See, I made the cardinal mistake of, like, building two really good decks that they were basically two decks that I would take to a tournament and then handing them to a player, another player, me having never actually played mine, right? So being an idiot, I didn't cheat a little bit. I didn't give myself a good chance to win. I actually was a proper gentleman, and we played on equal footing with two pretty well-built decks and fully painted squads. So it was pretty nice. It was a very fun game. It's a little bit late at night, but it was still great.
So who played what?
I played Stormcast.
You played the Stormcast?
Yeah, he played Steelheart's Champions, and I played my Earth Hogs, a.k.a. Orky Space Wolf Boys.
Nice.
Yeah, and all the cards went my way. It was a pretty ridiculously good deck.
Well, I know, Paul, you got another game of Shadespire in with your Tzeentch. How did you like those?
I did. It was fun. They played so much different than the Golden Boys. A couple of them died a lot easier than I got used to with my one game of Stormcast. But they were fun to play. Some interesting tricksiness to them.
Cool. Can you summon with them? I know they introduced magic in the new stuff. Are you able to summon?
Yeah, one of the guys can summon a blue horror, and then when the blue horror is killed, he becomes one of the little flame guys.
A brimstone horror.
A brimstone, yeah,
that's it. Mm-hmm. And then the brimstone horror dies, and then you can resummon a blue horror.
Right. Yeah. So it works exactly how it does in the AOS,
which is pretty cool.
Yeah, but what's interesting though is that when you summon him, you can put him on any deployment spot.
Yeah, I'm gonna have to look at their rules for AOS and see how they play in Azine Charmy.
Oh, and I played a 30-point game of Song of Ice and Fire as well. And based on that game, decided to start painting minis. So that should tell you everything you need to know about how much fun I had with it.
I'd like to take a moment and listen to your experience on that, because I'm interested in that game, and especially with some of the new stuff that's come out, what your thoughts might be on that.
Yeah. So it's really good, you guys. It's a good game. I said a couple episodes back, I wanted a good rank and flank game. And it's got a lot of the things that I like. The friend that I played with, we had some jokes and we were calling it, a song of shitty morale checks, because it can boil down to some, like, morale is crazy in this game. I'll say that, but it's very thematically justified. And every time the morale checks happen and they don't go well, it's generally seems okay. I think you can't lose a whole unit due to them. And in general, I think maybe the complaint is overblown. But I'll also say that we played two games, really. Actually, I played one game in the configuration where you have spots that you hold on the map. And then I played another one that's a lot like Malifaux, where each round you draw a public objective, and then each player is given two objectives in secret for that round. And you're trying to both do the public thing for victory points and also both accomplish your private goals for victory points. And that was the Winds of Winter was the name of that scenario. And it's awesome. I could play that over and over and over and over and over again, not get sick of it. It was very, very good. I will also say that the actual core mechanics of the game are just so slick. Everything that I said in the Song of Ice and Fire episode, I think, holds true to my experience actually playing the game, which is surprising, because generally, you know, you get super hyped and you have a way of thinking about a game when you read the rules, and then you kind of find different things as you play. But I feel just as charged about the game and as I did after reading the rules, having played it. It's really good. So that was a lot of rambling. I didn't really organize my thoughts very well about my experience playing it, and still kind of raw in my memory too. But I can say that again, I immediately started painting an entire unit of Stark Sworn Swords. So I liked it. I liked it enough that I want to paint it.
So I'm looking at the website right now, because you've been sending me and Paul a lot of text messages with some book, some stuff that you've been getting, because you got the Kickstarter, and then also some of the future stuff. So I've noticed that obviously Night's Watch is now a thing for the game.
Yeah. So the next two factions are Night's Watch and the Free Folk. So those north of the Wall.
So that was going to be my question. Is Night's Watch an actual army, or is it going to be something like the Boltons, where they're kind of just allies? They're not
no,
an actual
they're
army.
An army. They're an army. Yeah.
Oh, shit.
And
I'm
they're,
done.
They're, and hang on, because they're thematic as fuck. So, all right, let's talk about a couple things about these releases, because Paul had some concerns during the Song of Ice and Fire episode, specifically about Simon's support of the game. And I think that still remains to be seen what the long-term support picture is going to look like. But now that we've seen what new army releases are going to actually be like, I think there's reason to be very excited. And so I'll talk about how this is going to work now. There are only two types of SKUs for this game. There are small box SKUs and army box SKUs. So every small box SKU is $30. That's it. So there'll be unit boxes, hero boxes, cavalry boxes, all that. All those boxes, they're all the same size, physically the same size, and they're all $29.99 MSRP. And there are also army boxes, which are $89.99, and they will always be $89.99. But we need to talk about what comes in those boxes, because I think they're the... Without dredging into hyperbole, they're the best starter boxes in any miniatures game on the market. And I'll go into a little bit about that and back it up. So the first thing to note is that you get a full tournament list in the box. That's that. I mean, that in and of itself qualifies it very heavily for what I just said. The standard tournament size in a Game of Thrones or in a Song of Ice and Fire is 40 points, and you get 40 point lists in these boxes. And 40 points is generally four units. So, you know, two basic troop choices, an elite troop choice, and then something big and gross, and then some non-combat units, and you get all those units, right? In the box. So first and foremost, before I get into the other stuff, I mean, you guys, are there any other games you can think of off the top of your head where the starters give you tournament lists? I mean, Guild Ball, maybe?
Guild Ball.
Yeah, that's about it.
I know there's one other out there that I was thinking of.
And also, let's talk about Guild Ball, because the resin starters are $80, and I don't want to equate the quality of the plastic that's in the Song of Ice and Fire. I don't want to equate the plastic the same way, but the fact remains that when you spend the $90 on the Song of Ice and Fire book, you're gonna get for sure 40 models. Probably more like 50 models. And in some factions, it's gonna be even like into the mid-50s. So 50 models, that's what you're going to be looking at when you buy this $90 starter.
Hmm.
Now, talking about a little bit higher than that, you also get a rule book. Now, again, there's a lot of games out there, 40K, where you don't necessarily get a rule book with everything that you buy, right? And that goes to say with a lot of war games. So let's say you went out and you bought a theme force for War Machine or Hordes. You're going to pay $170. You get like 30 or 40 models, and you can get the free rules online, sure, but you don't get a nice little book that you can reference at the table. Just doesn't happen when you buy the box. You do get a full rule book when you buy these starter sets. Now, here's the thing that blew my goddamn mind. I had no idea. I have my rule book. I got the rule book out of the Stark and Lannister starter that the Kickstarter backers got. It's great. It's got a lot of art in it, but all the art is Stark and Lannister art. And it didn't even occur to me that they would tailor every rule book to the starter box that it comes in, but they did.
Oh, so nice.
Yeah, so the Night's Watch starter has all Night's Watch themed art inside there in the rule book that comes in the box, as does the Free Folk starter. We'll have all Free Folk North of the Wall art in the rule book. So that's just like an incredible little touch, right? Like they didn't need to do it.
No, that's really nice. Yeah.
Yeah. They didn't need to do it, but they did it. So now let's talk about the next thing that you get in the starter box. You also get all the 2D terrain you could possibly need to populate a 4x4 foot board.
Right.
So it comes with cardboard cutouts with all the stuff you need. Now let's talk about this, because we haven't seen the contents necessarily of the Free Folk box, but we have seen the contents of the Night's Watch box, and the terrain that comes in the Night's Watch box is completely different from the terrain that comes in the two-player starter. There are some of the same things, but there's also a wildly different variety. So when you get the two-player starter, you get a lot of corpse piles, but you don't get any corpse piles in the Night's Watch box. Why do you think that might be? They burn their dead, right? They don't want their dead turning into White Walkers, so they burn them. And as such, there are no corpse piles that come standard in the Night's Watch box. That's thematic as shit, you guys. Like, it blows my mind that they went that far.
No, that is super awesome. I'm trying to find some pictures of the box. Like all CMON has out there is just the front of it. I don't see the minis.
But hold on, because we're still not done. Inside the starter box, you get a Night's Watch themed ruler, and you get Night's Watch themed dice with ravens on the sixes, or crows on the sixes. Whoops, sorry, that was a faux pas. You get crows on the sixes. So. Amazing, right? Like themed dice, a themed ruler, themed terrain, a 40 point list, and rules, and all the cards that you need. So all the unit cards, the attachment cards for all the configurations that you could possibly make out of the units that come in the box. $90. It's essentially a one player starter. It's everything you need. So if like one of your friends is like, hey, we're getting into this game, you should go pick up an army. You're not like, well, what list should I buy? Do I need this? Do I need that? You just buy this one box and it has literally fucking everything you need in it to play.
Yeah, that is awesome. I mean, I like the contents of it too. Like, I'm looking at here for the Night's Watch, you know, it's Jon Snow, it's his wolf, it's two units of swords, sworn swordsmen, rangers, Jorah Mormont.
Yeah. Master Aemon.
Yeah, I mean, I'm assuming Master Aemon's probably going to be your
he's an NCU.
That's what it was called, NCU. I couldn't remember.
Yeah, but here's the other thing that's, again, super thematic. So the thing you guys don't know about the game because you haven't played yet is, like, you have your main unit cards. So I'm going to show it to you guys in the camera so you can see. So, like, this is a unit card for Stark Sworn Swords. They show you all of the stuff you need to have. But also, on the left of the card, or the right-hand side of the card, there's also there's like a area that's cordoned off. And there are regular-sized cards that you slide into the top for unit attachments. They act kind of like adjuncts in the other side. And every single unit you hire can have one. And the reason I'm bringing this up is Jorah Mormont, he can be either an attachment or he can be an NCU, and you get cards for both. But here's the thing that's really cool, because there's a lot of characters like that where you can have them as, like, standard attachments or as NCUs, and they in their standard. So, like, Jaime Lannister, for example, when you put him in, he can be either a commander or just an attachment. But the funny thing about Mormont is he either has to be an NCU or he has to be your commander, because he's the Lord Commander, right? So if he's out on the field with you, he is your general, and there's no other way you can run it. Again, thematic.
Yeah, I'm liking that.
And
lot.
Hey, I want to just...
Go ahead, Chops.
One other thing I want to say about the Night's Watch is that, like, and again, the tactics cards, they're so thematic to your army. So I saw the tactics card for Take the Black, and I about lost my goddamn mind. So the way that it works, the trigger is after you kill an entire unit with a Night's Watch unit, you can play this tactics card and you get D3 plus one sworn brothers into your, like, basically adding them back into the ranks of your guys, or you can take one of their attachments and put the attachment in your Night's Watch guys, basically forcing them to take the black.
Fuck, that's cool. Oh, that is thematic as hell. I love that.
It's so good. But yeah, and all the armies are thematic like that. Like, when you, for example, one of the units I want to buy is the Tully Sworn Shields, because they're tough as nails. They're like the strongest defensive unit in the game. And that's exactly what they are in the book. The Tullys are like the impenetrable wall of the North. They are the strongest, most hardened defenders of the wall. And likewise, the Umber Berserkers are like ferocious. And again, thematic, right?
Oh, Chops, I hate you so much. Stop convincing me to buy another game.
I'm so sorry.
Because the thing is, like, so I mostly have watched the shows. Like, I have read the first book. I have read Game of Thrones. And the Night's Watch, like, was such a cool and interesting thing to me when I was reading that book. And I really, really liked the whole aspect of, you know, the Sworn Brotherhood, of taking that and, like, the going to get the criminals and what it used to stand for back in the prehistory of the book. And, like, that was cool to me, and I really attached to that, and now I have to buy this army.
Yeah, and the other thing to tell you about them too is, like, even again, all of them, they're the elite army. They have lower numbers, so you're not going to be able to hire as much. They're the elite, hard-hitting army, because that's what the Night Watch are. There aren't a lot of them, but they're fucking savages, right?
Yeah, they're crazy as hell.
They train every day. They're an army. They're a legit, real army that stands at the border of the wall.
And if anybody knows anything about me, I like playing those elite armies.
Yeah, and they are the one. They are the elite army.
Paul.
So since you just sold Potter on the Night's Watch, sell me on the Free Folk.
I don't know. Dude, yeah, they have giants. That's giants. One thing that's awesome.
You're done. Giants.
Yeah, that's really cool. One of the NCUs is Craster, and it's like one of my favorite models in the whole line. He's like fat and slovenly looking, and he's like lounging in a chair looking like the total asshole that he is.
Sounds right.
And that's really great. And like Mance is also in it, and I think I sent it to you guys in a text, and I mean it. I wish I could just buy the Mance sculpt by itself, because it's my favorite sculpt in the whole game. It's so good. And I would buy it on its own if I could. It's incredible. We don't know how they play. I don't know yet.
And do you have, I mean, so I know, I mean, I'm at Cool Mini's website right now, and there's like not a lot of information. So if people want to go and look this up, like, what is a good place for them to kind of go and look at these sculpts and look at these pre-orders that are coming out?
Man, I think the best way to do it, honestly, is to go to like Miniature Market or Amazon and look at the stuff that's there. Otherwise, there's a Facebook group for A Song of Ice and Fire Miniatures game, and the Facebook group has some really talented painters, especially if you want to look at somebody's version of the Mountain That Rides every day, because I feel like there's some amazing painter posting there a Mountain That Rides, because it's a huge miniature of the mountain on a horse, and it's one of the, I think it's like the like most iconic miniature in the range right now. But anyway, if you wanted to go to that Facebook group, you can see them, and they're there. As far as the Night's Watch stuff, if anybody follows Ash Barker at Guerrilla Miniatures Games, he's been posting pictures of them, and then I think it's I'm just gonna have to look it up. Wargamer Terry, she and her partner have been obsessed with this game, and they've been posting a lot of YouTube videos, so if you just, you know, search the game, you'll see Terry's videos on there as well. And they just got the Night's Watch box, and they do a big unboxing, and they talk about what's in there, and they show some sculpts.
Yeah, I tried watching that video at work, and for some reason the sound and the video weren't syncing, so it irritated me, so I stopped watching it.
Yeah, it makes sense. But I think that Ash is recording a battle report with the Night's Watch next week. He's painting them this week. I saw he had an update. He had just painted them all. And it seems like he's really into it, like him and Owen on the channel. It's funny, the first game they played, I couldn't tell how interested they were, but they just keep pumping out battle reports for it and buying more stuff, so it seems like they like it.
Cool. I'm gonna have to go watch that. I haven't watched them in a while, so I watched the very first one that they did when we first started talking about this, when you brought it to Paul's and I's attention. So I'm gonna have to definitely take a look at that.
Yeah, I would definitely watch the most recent one, because that first game, I felt this in my games too, that my first game I got stomped by the Lannisters, because they have so many morale tricks, and I didn't know what to do. And then the second game I did much better, because I had, you know, had some time to think about how to counteract that. And I was able to play much better. And the most recent battle report up on Guerrilla Miniatures Games is a much more representative example of what the gameplay is actually like.
Yeah, because that was after watching Ash's game, that was a concern of mine, was the morale, like just how much the Lannisters were just able to decimate the Starks in terms of just making them do morale checks and like models just disappearing.
Yeah, you just have to play to it, and you have to know that's a constant threat with the Lannisters, and you're going to lose some models to it, but there are also ways to play smart and not get, you know, and basically not have your pants around your ankles while they're doing those tricks.
So, well, Paul, are you there?
I'm here.
Do you want to chime in if you can?
Yeah, grumble, grumble, grumble.
I want to say, like, hopefully there's someone in the local area right now that's playing it, so that you could just like play a demo game or something.
Well, store is stocking a ton of it.
Is Game Theory, right?
Yeah,
Game Theory,
they have everything I think that's out currently in stock.
So I was there today. I didn't go over and look.
Yeah, they had two when I was over there last time. They had two of the starter boxes and one of each of the $30 boxes.
Okay, well, my question to you is, have you ordered that Amazon order that Chop showed us earlier?
No. No.
Why not?
Because I haven't.
Well, I'm going to Disney in 3 weeks. You're already back, so I have to save money now.
I'm not... I'm not going to tell people not to support their friendly local game stores, but I got to be real with you guys that are listening. It's $90 for the starter on Amazon, which means you can split it with a friend for $45 a piece, and there are over 100 miniatures in that. So, and there's also enough tokens and all the cards you need for both players. So outside of the rules, you can really just split the box for $45 a piece.
Yeah, and see, that's the cool thing, too, with them doing these starter boxes for each of the factions. Like, if I've split this with Paul, cool, you could keep all the shit that's, you know, that's not Stark-related, and then, you know, I'll have all the Night's Watch, like the book, the rulers, the terrain. I'll have all that when I buy the Night's Watch, because I'm getting correct. The Night's Watch. Like, that's correct. Done.
Yep, that's correct.
Especially since they put Jorah Mormont in there, because he's one of my favorite characters.
Yeah, and I've also heard from people who've had the Night's Watch that the Night's Watch plastic is really, really good. Like, the sculpts are a little sharper than the Stark and Lannister sculpts, and that's no dig on the standard sculpts in the game. They're pretty damn good.
Well, I mean, I think that's also coming out with, you know, with most games that are doing this that do Kickstarter. Like, the first sculpts, I think, on most Kickstarter ones are probably not as decent as the rest of them come out. I think they just get better as they go.
I would say these are on the same level. These are on the same level as Warlord and Mantic. That's where I would put the level, the quality of the sculpts and the sharpness of the sculpts. So if you've ever painted Warlord or Mantic miniatures, you're not gonna be disappointed with the quality of these plastics. You can't expect them to be Games Workshop or weird quality, or you know, like Corvus Belli or whatever. But they're pretty damn good, man. Like, as I look at them, I'm really happy with them.
Well, that addresses a lot of my issues that I had with the game initially, coming from bad experiences with Kamon. It's good to see that they're supporting it and working with it and keeping quality up, if not improving it.
Yeah, I mean, you have a lot of the same reservations with it that I had with Star Wars
Legion. Yeah, I would agree. Yeah. Paul does have the same kind of hang-ups with Kamon that you did with FFG.
Yeah, and I mean, and again, like, an FFG has completely, you know, dissuaded me, or not dissuaded me, but like, gotten rid of my reservations. Like, you know, with all the Boba Fett stuff that came out, the scouts that have just come out, and now they're even there's talking about some of the new Rebel stuff that was going to be coming out late December is coming out like earlier now, from what I'm hearing. So that, you know, they've done a good job of consistently pumping out the game and talking to the community and putting minis out. So, and I hope that this game does the same thing. I mean, I hope Cool Mini does it. You know, A Song of Ice and Fire is definitely an IP that a lot of people are super into, and I think they can be really successful if they do this right.
Yep, they've got game night kits, I think, coming soon. And I've got, so the FLGS in my area, they're opening up a second location closer to my house. And also, I've got a gaming convention coming up here in Madison in a couple weeks. And fully painted or not, I think I'm going to be running demos of the game at both the store opening for the new FLGS and at this upcoming convention. Cause it's really affordable, and it's approachable for board gamers too, because the rule book is 24 pages, which is not much more than, you know, if you were getting into like an Arkham Horror or like a Vita Lasarda game, like The Gallerist or Vinos, that's the density of the rule book that you're used to reading anyway. And the complexity is about the same. And I got to tell you, outside of The Other Side, wow, that's a weird sentence. Outside of The Other Side, I don't think that there's a miniatures game with less ambiguity in the rules.
That's a pretty big
at least
statement.
Based on what I ran into. It's very easy game to interpret.
That's a bold statement.
I mean, a lot of miniatures games have really ambiguous rules and wording. And the game's really consistent. The wording is consistent, and when they say a specific word, it only means to what that word means. They're very careful about their word. I mean, it makes sense. Eric Lang wrote the rules, and Eric Lang is a seasoned board game developer. The guy knows what the hell he's doing, and it shows.
That's good. And I'll agree, like, from what I've seen on the videos, that I feel like it might transition well for board games, because like the whole side aspect of the playing the Game of Thrones on the side of the game, like, that is definitely very board gamey, you know. So for people that aren't into the miniatures games or new into them, like, that do have played a ton of board games in the past, like, they will definitely have that comfort zone while they're learning the miniature aspect of it.
Yeah, it acts just like I didn't put this together until you said that, Chris, but that's actually a really, really smart comparison. It acts just like a worker placement game,
right,
where each one of the spaces is a specific action, and you put an NC, you put one of your non-combat units on it, and you get to take that action, and whatever your NCU does when they activate, they get to do that too. So you come up with these really cool combinations of like which NCUs go best on which spots, and taking those worker spots before your opponent can take them. So it does have that very, very straight translation from board games.
And that's actually one of the things that interests me the most. Like, I'm not a big board game player, just only because, you know, I don't have a lot of people to play board games with, but, you know, that aspect of the game actually super interests me more than the actual miniatures portion, because I'm not a rank and file type guy. You know, I started playing, you know, miniatures with Warhammer Fantasy back in whatever it was, like, its fifth or sixth edition. So, like, that's where I started. But I much prefer skirmish games. But that aspect alone, and then also now the Night's Watch boxes, like, got me super interested in looking at playing this game, like, more than just trying it out.
That's exciting. I'm glad you guys are going to give it a second look.
Now we just have to get Paul to buy it.
Yeah.
Well, yeah, I mean, demo it for me, man.
Huh?
Demo it for me.
How am I going to demo it for you if I don't have models?
You're going to buy the two-player starter set.
No. You buy it, and I will buy you Wild West Exodus stuff.
I could just buy myself Wild West Exodus stuff.
Yes, but if I buy it for you, I can do it at a trickle, and, you know.
Yeah, you'd just be excited that I couldn't bring good stuff against you then.
Yes. That way I control the flow of the game in more ways than one.
Yeah. All right, well, so, Chops, you guys both brought up a good point of how, I guess Potter brought it up first, of how this game's like a board game in some ways. So let's use that to segue into what's kind of a trend recently, especially, I guess, in the past, maybe 12 months of gaming, is that you're getting a lot more games that are kind of board gamer friendly. And sure. almost a hybrid kind of experience.
And I would say, yeah, we've started getting games that are straight up, they're board games masked as miniatures games.
Yeah.
And it is, and one of the biggest perpetrators of this is Games Workshop, really.
Yeah, I mean, and it's also the biggest, it's the biggest game in the group, right? So if we were to take this group of games and put it into a pile, the biggest game is Warhammer Underworlds. So Warhammer Underworld Season 1 being Shadespire and Season 2 being Night Vault are definitely the two biggest. And yeah, these are miniatures game, or these are board games that are masquerading as miniatures games. And the cool thing about it is, I think it's a really good way. I like these games for a lot of reasons. For one, it's like a great side game for any miniatures gamer. And I think if you step into the Facebook group for Warhammer Underworlds, you will quickly, if you're into the miniatures gaming community, you will quickly start to recognize faces from other big prominent groups. Because I am in the Big Malifaux group, because I am in a big Guild Ball group, because I'm in a big Infinity group, and because I'm also in a big A Song of Ice and Fire group, I have seen players from all of those communities, and some of them that are only in one or the other. So, like, I'm not going to call out names because I don't want to put out individual names, I guess, but there are people, like, in the Guild Ball community specifically, that are very prominent Shadespire players or Warhammer Underworlds players. And I think that says a lot, because these people have their primary game, but they love getting that Warhammer Underworlds in when they can.
Yeah, I've only gotten one game of Shadespire in after I bought it. It was a teaching in that Paul and I did. And I mean, I really, really enjoyed it, but then it was kind of, at the same time, a lot of these other games crept up that we started playing, and so I didn't get a lot into it. So I'm actually super happy that you've got Paul playing it now, because I really want to start playing it again, because I had a ton of fun playing it. I love the card aspect of it. that it was felt like that kind of like that fog of war, you know, it made it so every game that you played was going to be completely different every single time. You know,
it's 24 activation and it's over, right?
Right. Yeah, I mean, you can get 4, 5, 6 games in a night if you wanted to. I mean, mm-hmm. you know, this is something we could bring. We could play a full game of Wild West, and then you're like, all right, cool. We've still got like another 30 minutes before we need to get home. Let's play a quick game of Shadespire, and then boom, get 2 games in a night.
Absolutely.
Like, same thing with Kill Team now too. I mean, I know Shadespire is kind of the beast of the box right out there right now, but Kill Team, you could do the same thing. You know, it's another one of those small base games, and it's 20, 30 minutes.
I would even argue that Shadespire can be done a lot faster. Like I went to my friend Aaron's house. We ate lunch, set up Shadespire, played Shadespire and tore it down, and I was back to work eating lunch, playing Shadespire, and getting back to work within an hour.
Nice.
So it's a great game for that reason. That's why it's such a good side game, and it doesn't hurt that the rules are really good and that the game is almost artfully balanced. And I mean that truly, because if you look at tournament results, I think there is only one warband right now that hasn't won a major tournament. And so if you have one badly designed warband out of 10 at this point, that's pretty great. And that's not to say that they're bad. It's just that they haven't won a major tournament yet.
Yeah. I mean, I would say for Shadespire, one of the things that does disappoint me is the fact that they have, you know, Stormcast now have 3 warbands. Khorne has 2 warbands. You know, there's Lizardmen don't have anything. You know, Nurgle doesn't have anything. Slaanesh doesn't have anything. Elves don't have anything. Like, that is a little disappointing for me. I know that they're putting out, you know, like, we've got dwarves, we've got orcs, we've got 2 undead of 2 different undead varieties, because we have like skellies and then we have the Nighthaunts, which Nighthaunt are now their own faction. So like, I'm good with that. So, but that is a little, as a Stormcast player, I am telling you guys, I'm upset that I have 3 freaking warbands to choose from.
It's a valid concern. And it's also worth noting that 2 of the 3 of those are considered the best warbands in the game. At least one of them, I guess. The Farstriders are, I think, considered the best of the group.
Yeah, when you throw ranged into there, I can see why. Like, that's a range group, and that's such a small board, and I think range has such a leg up on all the other melee factions, especially like orcs and Khorne. But now with spellcasters in there, it might be balanced out a little bit better now.
But again, it is worth noting that every warband has won a major tournament, not like minor little around tournaments. Every warband but the Skellies, but at the Sepulchral Guard, have won a major tournament. And I think I want to springboard this into why this game is so successful outside of the fact that it's Games Workshop. So I think Games Workshop's influence can't be understated. It's very important to note Games Workshop's presence when we talk about this game, but also their support for this game has been amazing. I don't know if you guys know much about the tournament kits. Do you guys know?
Mm-mm. I don't. Paul?
All right. So they come with... Paul, do you know? I'm going to take that
internet.
As a no.
Crappy internet strikes again.
Yeah, yeah. And, you know, I can't resist a chance to talk for 10 minutes. But the game night groups or the game night kits, they come with, like, acrylic tokens. They come with alternate art. And also they come with a glass trophy. And the thing about the glass trophies is that they tie into the lore of the game, because the whole thing about Shadespire is about shade glass. And so the idea is that these trophies are supposed to be representative of a piece of shade glass. And so you've started to have this group of community of players now that are called glass chasers. Right. And so they've got these people in the UK and in certain regions in the US that will travel to tournaments because they want to win more glass. And this is like fostering this really, really interesting competitive group of players that are like always trying to like protect their net, their decks from being like net decked and dissected. And they're like coming up with tricks and showing up to tournaments. And it's, I've had a really good time from the sidelines, just reading about the tournament play in this game. And, you know, seeing people, you know, basically posting a picture, like a family photo with like their five pieces of shade glass. I just think that's really cool.
You're doing it again. I want to go up and grab my models and well, I've almost got my Steelheart, because I use actually Steelhearts in my actual Stormcast army, so those guys are actually almost fully painted. But I don't have my Khorne guys or my my Skellies painted, because I bought the Skellies too.
And the Skellies are hard right now just because of the state of the game. But we should bring this back to what Paul was saying, was that where these are like board games, right? So
right,
people who don't know how this works, it's a game that's played on a hex map. And it's got specific squares for deployment. And then at the start of the game, you set up five objective hexes. And then the way the game goes is there's three game rounds. And in each game round, either player gets four alternating activations. And that's activations are moving units, charging units, putting them on defense, all that kind of stuff. And essentially what you're trying to do is get victory points. And you've got two decks of cards. You have one deck of cards that has your upgrades and ploys, which are cards that you can play at specific times in the game. And then you also have your glory deck, which is where you draw cards. And in those cards, you're going to have three in your hand, and those give you an opportunity to score points. And that's what you're scoring. You're not necessarily going to always get points for killing, even though there is stuff for killing, but really it's an objective based game. And we've talked about in previous games, the thing that I really like is hidden objectives. And the fact that you can like tailor these objectives, and then you have to adapt your strategy to the ones that you draw, is a really interesting thing to me. We did note that the game is very well designed and that the rules are very good, but this is just to sort of illustrate that, you know, this board game has lots of influence pulled from both the board game side and the miniatures game side. And it really pulls those two forces together in a very elegant and easy to digest and fast playing package. It's really great.
Sounds like a lot of fun when you're looking at it from the competitive aspect, because I mean that was one of the things that drew me, not from the competitive aspect, but like what you're talking about is like with the deck, the deck was that interesting component that made it more than just a board game to me, where you could just look at it from that ultra competitive mindset. Because when Shadespire first came out, like that was the whole point of it. It was like, they were like, this is going to be a competitive game. And I just wasn't seeing how that was going to be happening. I was like, this is just a board game. Like I wasn't seeing that. And now what you're just talking about, like, I can see that now, the way you just explained it. I can see how that is. It's making this game a competitive game.
Yeah. It's fiercely competitive. And I would wager that next year at LVO, the second biggest game there is Shadespire or Warhammer Underworlds. So it'll be 40K and then Underworlds. The Underworlds Grand Clash at LVO will be the second biggest tournament at the event.
I think that's a pretty good bet.
Yeah, because I mean, there's players from every other game, right? Like every other game that's going to be played at LVO, there's going to be players there that are going to want to play in the Shadespire Grand Clash. I'll hang my hat on that. I think it'll be the second biggest game there.
Yeah, I don't think you'd be wrong on that. I mean, I think we'll start seeing that, you know, this March, you know, coming in with that's right, LVO's in next month.
No, isn't it February?
Yeah. No, February. LVO's in November, isn't it?
No, it's February.
Mm-hmm. Is it February? I thought it was November.
It's the first big one of the new year usually.
Right, because Adepticon's the second one.
Yep.
Yeah. So we'll and maybe we'll get to see some of that when if we get to go to Adepticon. So.
Oh yeah, we're gonna play in the Grand Clash. If you guys have your Shadespire stuff, I don't care. It's like $15 to play in the Grand Clash, and even if we get our asses kicked, it's like 3.5 hours. Who cares?
Right.
Yeah.
As long as it's not when WWX is playing.
Well, yeah. See, and here's the problem. Hopefully, I'll get signed up, because when signups are happening for Adepticon, I'll be in Disney. So if Paul can sign me up, I'll definitely get in.
Well, I don't think you need to worry too much about the tournament selling out right away.
Just getting that badge in the first place.
Get the badge. Yeah. Well, yeah. I mean, so this will be my first experience of going to a con where you have to pay for the tournaments, because I've always gone to TempleCon, and TempleCon you don't pay for the tournaments. Because it's pretty much just a giant privateer press con. At least it used to be. I don't know if it's changed since it's moved months, and now that Lock and Load is a thing. But like, there was like some 40K, there was some X-Wing, but I mean, you're talking, you had like 60 tables for privateer press, and you had like 4 tables for everything else.
Yeah, it's a little different at Adepticon, but
yeah, this will be an experience for me.
And you need a shopping day at Adepticon too, because there's a huge exhibition hall.
Damn it!
But
I am getting my birthday money early from my parents.
But let's get this thing a little bit further in. So Paul mentioned he wanted to talk about this as a topic, and I think we've only talked about the big gorilla, but we need to talk about the other games that actually occupy this space. There are a few that are out. So Aristea, which is Corvus Belli's miniature game, is basically the way that it's set up is that if you know anything about Infinity, it's that they can basically, your consciousness exists on a cube, and they can basically put your cube into a body. And there are the resurrected, essentially, embodiments of lots of famous people. So like Wild Bill Hickok, and like Achilles, and
Joan of Arc.
Miyamoto Musashi, Joan of Arc, right? So all these people have been resurrected. Basically, they, you know, through using cubes, and there's a lot of stuff in the lore about it. But anyway, because of
the Running Man, basically,
people are functionally immortal, and Aristea is like a blood game. So it's a game that's like live televised, where essentially people are doing like real life area control and killing each other on this battlefield for entertainment of the people watching. And the board game is a representation of this blood sport, Aristea. So it's another game where you've got a hex based grid objectives, but it's cool because even though it has custom dice, it uses the same face to face roll mechanics that Infinity does. And it's got that really good, really great rules interactions that Infinity is known for, just on a board game scale. I've played 4 games of Aristea, and it's one of those games that, like Infinity, I'd love to play it, but I don't have the time or money. But I think it's worth noting that if you're interested in Corvus Belli's stuff and you don't want to take the full dive into Infinity, you should definitely look at Aristea, because there is some fantastic minis, and that is a very well designed game.
And they also have a trigger system, almost in some ways, kind of like Malifaux.
It is a trigger system.
They call it Switch.
It's just like
Malifaux,
Switch
system, right?
Yeah.
Or you can
switches. Yep.
Choose some of your dice options to do something different, like push another player or things like that. Add a die.
Exactly. Yeah, so you roll your dice, and the dice have different symbols that mean different things, and there are symbols that you can use, and you basically spend them, like Paul said, on different stuff in the game.
I've never actually heard of that one. I didn't know that Corvus Belli made another game. I thought they only did Infinity. This is the first I've heard of this.
I mean, Aristea is an Infinity game. It's in the Infinity universe, but yeah, it's super cool, man. And if you go and look at the minis, like Hexer is really cool. There's a lot of very cool minis in that game. There's like a panda dude. He's awesome.
Puma Man.
Oh man, I don't think we can go an episode without making an MST3K reference.
He's called B-Ball. That's awesome.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's 8-Ball. It's 8-Ball.
Oh, it's 8-Ball. Yep. Oh, the way that the font made it,
it looks like
the font made it look like it was.
Yeah, it's definitely 8-Ball.
Is that the the panda?
Yeah, the panda.
Now, I'm going to assume that these minis are metal, just like the rest of Corvus Belli's.
They're gorgeous, man.
So the original limited edition set were metal cast, but they are plastic.
So that makes me happy. Like, I would play this because one of the things I as much as I love metal minis for the detail, like, as I've gotten older, I don't want to deal with that shit. I just give me the plastic minis. They're easier to build. They're easy to transport. The paint doesn't rub off of them as easily. Just give me plastic minis. And that is one thing about Infinity that did bother me, was everything is still metal.
Oh, then you should definitely look into Aristeia. And the cool thing about Aristeia, especially if you want to get into one of these games, and it's not, I mean, or I don't know, it may be not that, but if I'll continue that thread, actually, if you want to get into one of these, Aristeia is actually not a bad choice, because the way that you list build in this game is a lot different than the way that you list build in Shadespire, where, or Underworlds, where in Warhammer Underworlds, you have to choose the warband and then you build the decks. In Aristeia, you draft the people that are going to be on your team at the beginning, just based on what your opponent's drafting. So you bring in all the minis you have painted or all the minis you want in your pool, and then you draft the ones that you want based on the game and the scenario that comes in. And it makes it so it's kind of like Overwatch meets Warhammer Underworlds.
And then you get to build a deck on top of it based on who you brought.
Based on who you brought, yep.
I'm kind of okay with that analogy of Overwatch meets Shadespire. I'm okay with that.
Yep, that's the same connection that Owen and Ash made too, was that it was very Overwatchy.
Yeah,
I mean, it is.
And I could, you mean, and that the Overwatch feel definitely fits Corvus's, you know, their mini style. You know, it's that anime kind of style.
Right. Big characters.
Ooh, Chops, I can see what you're saying now. I see one of their plastic models that are unpainted. It is definitely not up to their metal standards.
No, it's not. It's not. But
they're still really good. They're still really good models. Like, don't get me wrong. Like, I'm not trying to put them down. Corvus has some of the most beautiful pewter models on the market right now.
In my personal
opinion. Beautiful pewter models. I don't think any company's doing it. Is Privateer is probably the only people that are coming close, and I just think Corvus Belli's got a higher quality than Privateer does. But these plastics are still good. It's just, they're definitely not their metal quality.
Right, but I mean, you're not going to get that, right? That's why you have metal, is because that's why you buy metal minis, is for that Christmas of detail. But, you know, you get what you get, and Aristeia is not that expensive. So, it's pretty cool, and it's a great system. So that's another one.
And now, before you go on, Chops, one interesting thing to talk about in Aristeia is the initiative system, because it's unlike anything I've seen. In that you have your four players, and you basically predetermine the order at which you're going to activate. Right, so you have four slots on your board. You put down the card that matches your players in the orders that you want to activate them. And the other person does the same thing. And then, so you each take your first slot, you flip your card, and whoever has the better initiative number is the one that gets to go first.
That's correct. It's fascinating.
Yeah, so it's very interesting in that you can build each turn depending on where you think, all right, well, this guy's likely to go first, I really need him to go, so I'm going to slap him in turn one, or I need, you know, where to put those people who have the better activation chance of going
versus where you need them to go in the turn, right?
Exactly.
Like, you may need someone to activate last because they're going to do the thing that's going to get you the points at the end of the round.
Yep, I think that was when I was looking into the game and just trying to get an idea for how it worked. That was the thing that really stuck out to me. That and the one scenario that I kept seeing people play, where the first turn you're fighting for a zone in the middle, but then whoever loses the turn gets to determine what section of the board is going to be the next scoreable zone.
Yep.
Really cool scenario, I thought.
Yeah, it's very well thought out, and it really conveys that, like, TV Bloodsport, like, really well in that specific scenario.
Yeah, I mean, I think, Paul, I think you had nailed it on the head. I think you said it was Running Man earlier, pretty much. Yeah, I think you had nailed it on the head for that.
All right, sorry, Chops, I didn't mean to interrupt too much, but go ahead.
No, that's good. I'm glad you brought that up, because I would have rolled right over it, and you're right. That is a fascinating mechanic in Aristeia.
Yeah, I didn't think we should miss that.
All right. So there are three more games we should talk about, but we're going to go long. So let's talk about the game that I think the three of us in this space, and I'm saying this in hoping that you're agreeing with me, but this is the one that I think between the three of us we're most excited about. And that would be God Tier from Steamforge.
Oh, yeah.
I know Paul is, I mean,
I think Potter's out on this one.
I think I am. I mean, I've seen a couple of the games of it. I've seen it played in person now a few times with, we got, you know, a couple guys in the community here that were in the beta, got to watch the games being played. I never got to play it myself, so I'll hold my reservations fully until I actually get hands-on models, play the game. But, I am not a MOBA fan. I just don't like that style of play. And being that God Tier is pretty much a board game miniatures game that is a MOBA, it right off the bat, it's off-putting to me. But like I said, I will hold reservations until I play it. The miniatures are fantastic, though. Everything that I've seen that Steamforge has come out with these guys, the models, they're beautiful. Fantastic. Both Kickstarter set models are great. I absolutely love them. So from that aspect, I think Steamforge is knocked out of the park. And from everything I hear, the rule set is very tight. It's very fun. You know, going from beta Kickstarter to or from alpha Kickstarter to beta Kickstarter, I've heard nothing but good things about the improvement of the game system. So I am hopeful for it as a game because I want Steamforge to be successful. I like them as a company. But yeah, me right now, I'm kind of off on God Tier.
All right. I'll take that. And I think as it comes closer to release, and if you see some, like I just read the finalized rule book and all the finalized scenarios, and I'm very excited for it. So for people who don't know, God Tier is Steamforge, aka the Guild Ball guys and the Dark Soul guys and the Resident Evil 2 guys. And now the Horizon guys.
Yeah, Horizon Zero Dawn. Yep.
Yeah. It's their new IP, so their first original IP since the onset of Guild Ball, and it is as Chris noted pretty well. It is a sort of MOBA style game. I think it's a little different than the way we traditionally think about the PC game MOBAs, but that isn't a totally unfair comparison. And the way that the game works is that you hire essentially three champions, and then each champion is representative of a specific play style, and then each one plays differently inside of that play style, and they each come with a set of minions, and the minions are also going to be like thematically tied to the champion that you hire. And once you hire, the thing that I think separates God Tier from a lot of these other games is the game board itself. And by that, I mean the representation and amount of hexes is much higher than all of the other games that occupy this space currently, outside of maybe Monsterpocalypse, which is a square based game, but there are tons of squares on the map. God Tier has a huge board. And also it's worth noting that God Tier has, I think, the most interesting mechanic in all of these games, in that there are two specific activation phases. One of them is I go, you go, and one of them is alternating activations. And every unit in the game has two different sides to their card, one for each phase of the game. So in the planning phase, you have one side, and in the action phase, you have the other side. And the miniatures will act and can do things specifically in these two different phases. And it sets up a very interesting flow of play. And I'm just constantly fascinated when I read battle reports and I look at these cards and I read them. Paul, I don't know if you want to chime in if I missed anything there specific that you wanted to mention.
I think you nailed that. And one of the things that I was thinking as you were saying that is that it solves one of the problems that every game where you have cards, you always end up in trouble. And that's remembering who you've activated. Because all you do is flip over their card and you know that they've gone. And I know that sounds dumb, but how many times when you're playing Malifaux or Wild West Exodus or War Machine, you go, oh shit, who have I activated?
Yeah, I don't think that's actually a trivial thing. I think that they designed it like that on purpose, and I think that's a very smart design decision on their
part.
And
sneaky for it to be that clean and efficient.
Yep, I agree. I'd say that should absolutely be noted, that it lets you keep track of your activations. Keeping track of your activations is actually a mechanic built into the game, and it doesn't feel like it's built into
right,
the game.
Right, and that's just it. You don't even realize it. Like, it wasn't until you were talking about it that I was like, wait a second. You know who you've activated based on that. That's brilliant.
You do. Yeah, it's really good. And also the scenarios are worth talking about, because the theme of this game, God Tier, essentially is that their gods have essentially died. And I haven't read a lot of the fluff, even though I'm a pretty big fluff bunny. But the way that I understand it is that the gods have perished. And in the gods perishing, they sort of exploded into these MacGuffins called God Tiers, or as they died in the heavens. And your champions are basically people that have started to absorb these, because as a person absorbs the tears, they gain in strength and size. And so each one of these games is sort of like a border skirmish, where like a bunch of allied champions are meeting to try and like scrounge up and then share these tiers that have fallen. And so you are trying to use your band to beat the other team's band. And these god tiers are, they affect the battlefield in very unique ways, and they affect the scenario. So like growth, as an example, is one of the scenarios. And the god tiers in growth, the way that it works is that there are three very small scoring areas at the beginning of the game, but each round the scoring area gets larger, and you have to sort of work around that. And then there's a scenario that's the inverse of that too, where the scoring areas start big and then get smaller.
And the other thing to point out too is that, kind of like Ariesta, is that it's the person who didn't score the points last time that get to determine which ones either disappear or
yeah, grow. Exactly. Yep. Yep. And also fascinating about this game is that the victory that is essentially like, and correct me if I'm wrong here, and I just want to make sure that I interpreted this correctly in my quick glance the other day. The way that the scoring works is the person who wins each round, as you win a round, winning that round is worth a certain amount of points. And then the way that you win is based on, it's sort of like a seesaw. There's a ladder on one side of the mat, and you move your piece up and down that ladder based on your performance in the round. And so it's okay to win or lose certain rounds as long as you get to that magic victory point level that will allow you to win the game.
Right. And the interesting thing too, or as you like to say, fascinating. The fascinating thing is that as the game goes on, the turns are worth more points. But then you kind of
right,
bell curve out, and then it starts being worth less.
Yeah, and then the way that the other thing that's really great about that is it makes the game a variable length.
Right.
So
it's what turn three, four, or five, right?
Yeah. If you're getting stomped, the game is not going to last very long. Which is really good, right? Because that's actually, and that's a clever way, just like you were mentioning the card flipping is a clever way to keep track of activations. The way this game is scored is actually a clever way to beat off negative play experiences. Beat off was a bad turn of phrase there. Ward off bad play experiences.
Oh, man.
So it's true, right? Like if you're getting beaten really badly, the game isn't going to last. You don't have to play the whole game because your opponent's going to score the requisite amount of victory points, and you're not like playing useless turns going, God damn it, I can't win this game.
So what you're saying is that if you're going to get beat off really bad, you're not going to last as long.
Yes. Yep, that is what I'm saying.
And Paul's internet kicks in just enough to give that bad joke.
I definitely asked for it.
Yeah, you kind of did.
As it was coming out of my mouth, I was like, God damn it. But anyway,
yeah, go on, yeah.
Seems real good. And anybody who's interested, go. The rules are out right now. I don't know if non-Kickstarter backers can download the rules. I'm not sure. I can download the rules because I Kickstarted it, but you should go see if you can. I believe there is a big God tier page on Steamforge site. And then the other thing to do is to, and I know all three, a couple of us have mentioned this, maybe just Chris, but it is worth noting that Russ Charles brought his fucking A game here. And the sculpts and miniatures in this are top fucking tier.
Good Lord. The giant dwarf is amazing.
Some of the best miniatures I've ever seen.
Right. The dwarf is just ridiculous.
The dwarfs are great. And Wraith Merid is like, I think one of the best sculpts in any miniatures game, period.
I mean, the elemental models are really good too. And that like, Minotaur model is probably one of the best Minotaur models I've ever seen in my life.
Oh yeah, he's great. And I don't know if you've seen, so you've only seen, it's funny the way they did this. They released the alpha kit, and the alpha kit came with metal models, and the metal models are all the optional buys from the Kickstarter. So if you, and the reason they did this is so because they wanted their alpha players to still back the game. So the game itself, what it comes with is all the champions that aren't those ones you've seen. So what I want to say, Chris, if you didn't pay attention, is you should go look at the models that actually come in the box, because they're all different from the ones you've seen. The dwarf isn't in there. Lorsane, the elf archer, isn't in the main box. Like, none of those characters are in the main box. But you need to go look at, like, Grim Shala, which is, like, the Nurgle-looking one. So good. And I can't think of the name of the one that looks like a harrow, the like undead one right now, but that one is also amazing.
Just so you know, the rules are available for download on the Steamforge God tier website. At Steamforge,
yeah, they just finalized them.
Yeah, it's steamforge.com/godtier. You can download the rules there.
And if that's not some dick swinging confidence from Steamforge, I don't know what is. That I think you could probably proxy the whole game if you wanted to right now, because you can probably download the cards there. I know I can. If you can download the rules, you might be able to download the cards, and I know I can download both.
Oh shit! Those skeletons are badass. Yep.
I told you.
Oh my god, those are cool.
Yeah, they're so good.
Oh, I like the look. I like the freaking knight, like angel looking dudes. What are?
Yeah, and Sneaky Pete is also amazing. I think that's going to be the first champ and minions that I paint.
Yeah, there you go. Titus Dishonored. That armor is fucking lit.
Oh, yeah. Titus is real cool. Dude, it's all good, man. All those minions. And again, you haven't seen any of those, right? Because those are all...
No, these are the first ones.
Yeah, it's not Rangosh. It's not Wraith Merid. It's not the champions that came in the alpha kit.
Yeah.
Yeah, because I've seen Rangosh before. I've seen Rodri, Lorsane... Wraith Merid,
right.
Shale. I've seen the... Oh my god, what the fuck is Grim Shala?
Amazing.
I told you, dude. Grim Shala's amazing.
Holy crap, that model is awesome.
Yeah, again, they're like I said, Russ Charles was not playing. They gave him art direction, and he went all the way. He hit a home run. That guy is an incredible sculptor.
Oh, these models are these new ones. The ones I haven't seen before. These are, I mean, because I always loved Shale. Like, I thought Shale's model was really, really cool, but that Grim Shala just knocks the shit out of the park.
I'll describe Shale for our listeners. So Shale is the champion. Where Shale is not actually the champion. Shale is a golem, and the Shale's controller is like a badass looking wizard on a rock, and then Shale is a giant like rock colossus. Is super cool.
He's affectionately known in the Raleigh area as Dave.
All right.
I live in the Raleigh area and I don't get the joke.
No, that's just what he's called, is Dave.
Dave's not here, man.
By Raleigh area, I mean myself and friend of the show, Jim.
I was about to say, because you two were the only ones playing.
Yes, he's.
But yeah, I'm really hyped for God Tier, and I think it's coming out April.
Yeah, April. The last email update.
Paul, I'm gonna have to play this with you, man, because these new minis, holy. Sneaky Pete's awesome. I like that model.
Dude, yes, Sneaky Pete's great. I love Sneaky Pete. I love the way they spelled Sneaky Pete too. I'm not gonna spoil that for the listeners. You should go check it out.
Yeah, and also you can download the rules from their Kickstarter page now too, because that's where all the pictures of the minis are. Because God Tier's website literally does one of two things: download the rules, go to Kickstarter. That is all that webpage does right now.
And as Steamforge is a very community based company, the whole process of the rule writing and revisions after the Kickstarter has been entirely public. I think based on their shortcomings in previous Kickstarters where they haven't been communicative enough, they've learned all those lessons and they've essentially released champions to the playing public. And the way that they've play tested this game is that they push the rules out and the cards out to the entire player base that Kickstarted the game. And all these people that have access to their proxy models and the metal models that they got for alpha testing. And they've been rigorously pay tested and then finalized as the development crew is satisfied that they become balanced and are at the correct power level and playing thematically. So you don't have to worry about whether or not this game was rigorously play tested, because I'm here to tell you it fucking was. And because of that, I think the game is going to be very, very good, because people have been trying to break it outside of Steamforged for the entirety of its development.
Yeah, and that was obviously with seeing that Steam. I couldn't tell if Paul was talking or not.
I'm not sure either. You should make your point though, Chris.
Yeah, I'm going to make my point anyways. Paul's not here, man. So the point that I was having was that one of the reasons why I didn't kickstart this, because when Steamforge announced this at SteamCon, you know, I was excited about it. Look, you know, from the aspect of looking at it, way they were talking about the tournaments and how you, when you go into a tournament, it's not going to be the same kind of thing where it's like you've got your army, you build it, and you go on to the next one. It's you build your army, you get points, and your champions are able to level up, and they go through this whole thing. And it was really interesting seeing how they were going to do that for the tournament aspect. But then they came out and was like, okay, we're going to do a Kickstarter. I'm like, well, that kind of sucks. I don't really like Kickstarter to begin with. And then also they've already got a bad rap with Dark Souls. And that was it kind of it for me in terms of backing it right then and there with those two reservations. So I am really glad to see that Steamforged learn their lessons, especially as I go into Horizon Zero Dawn with that new board game and Resident Evil right now. So that makes me happy that they did a lot better with this game.
Yeah, it seems like they turned it around.
Okay.
I didn't back Horizon because I just started paying for daycare, but that game looked pretty cool too. But yeah, that's God Tier. And I think with Paul's mic being not super great, I think we should save the discussion on especially Monsterpocalypse for another episode. And I think we may do a full episode on Monsterpocalypse because I know you guys are really excited about it. It seems like there might be a community starting up here, and that might make me excited enough to play it, especially since you don't have to paint a ton of shit. It's just like your big models and then those like small models that are like base coat and wash and done.
We've got a couple of people down here that are looking to play it as well too. I think Paul, friend of the show, Jim, and Kevin Babb, I think they all have kits, and I'm going to pick one up, but it probably won't be until after the first of the year.
Yeah, I've got the other side looming imminent, and I've got all of these Stark minis to paint now, so I'm pretty good for a while. But yeah, Monsterpocalypse is another one, and I think a game that we should do this, because I always surprise you guys with a little bit of a thing in left field, and there is a game that fits into the category of games that we're talking about that is live and on Kickstarter right this moment, and it actually just went up on Kickstarter, So you should look up and give me just a second here. It's called The Edge. And you should look into it. I'm just going to give you a Google phrase. I think the edge downfall. If you search the space edge space downfall, you will get to the Kickstarter. And the one you're looking for is The Edge Downfall version 1.6 by Awaken Realms. And start giving that a look, and we'll give some live impressions right now on the show, live and in person, what you guys think about this game. Holy shit, it's already up to $777,000 on Kickstarter. And while these guys are looking in and they're starting to note it, I will say that this game is actually released. What they have on Kickstarter right now is essentially the second printing of this game. And I will say right now, as it stands, this game is one of the highest rated games on BoardGameGeek, period. Based on its current ranking, it could go into the top 20 all-time games on BoardGameGeek. Another thing that I'll note about this game right away is that the developer, whose last name I'm not going to try to pronounce, it's like Mikal or Ax or something, it's like a Czech name, but he is also the designer of one of my, I don't know if I would call it my favorite board games, but it's one of my very favorite board games, Neuroshima Hex. I don't know if anybody out there has it on their phone. If you don't, you should get it. Otherwise, maybe check out the board game. Neuroshima Hex is one of the best design board games ever, in my opinion. And this is his newest game. It fits into this category where you have a faction, and then that you push that faction into narrative-based scenarios. And it's a hex-based game. I would encourage anybody to go and look, but really what I wanted these live impressions on for you guys, now that you've had a second and you're looking at these miniatures, tell me how fucking gorgeous they are. Because I already know.
Dude, steampunk dwarves. I'm done. I'm fucking done. Yeah. I mean, with golems carrying dwarves, I'm done. These are, holy crap.
Yeah, they're really good, man.
These miniatures make me think of Guillermo del Toro designed a board game.
Yeah, they're really great. I think the Reborn miniatures there's a little bit too much cheesecake in that faction for me, but every other faction is super great.
Because I'm looking at the expansion, the Darkness. I think, yeah. And the Darkness was designed by Guillermo del Toro, like specifically that could have gone into Pan's Labyrinth right there.
Yep. Yeah, for sure. They're really great. Those like angel looking plague doctor dudes walking around on sword legs.
Yeah, these
pretty
are
cool.
These are beautiful. The only problem I have is that the fact if I even want to jumpstart into this, I have to pump up 175 pounds, and I don't even know what that is for, you know, US dollars for the conversion rate.
That's like 230 or something.
Yeah, I just don't have 230 because I would, just based on the sculpts, not even knowing anything about this, I would back this. These are beautiful models.
Yep. Yeah, 100%. And I'll say this, you can go watch some, the Dice Tower has a pretty good review of it. And also Beasts of War have a playthrough. And I think if you just watch a playthrough, you will quickly see how well designed this game is. It's very, very good. And again, if its rankings hold true on BoardGameGeek, it's going to be one of the highest rated board games of all time. So that's, and it's not just a Cult of the New thing. Everything that I've seen about it is I can't speak too much about it because I haven't read the rules, and it's very hard to understand the nuances of the rules just by watching Let's Plays. But I can tell you that it is a very interesting looking game. It's a really great game in that, like miniatures war games, all of them, positioning is so important, and managing your resources.